I cover this in our previous course. There was a course on the book, in the Book of Words. But since there are some people who are new to the Muslim Empire course, and also this sutta is somewhat valuable, I thought I would take it again. The sutta is especially important because it explains the two types of courses of karma. That is, the 10 courses of unwholesome karma and the 10 courses of wholesome karma. And so the sutta gives us also the opportunity to speak a little bit about the Buddha's teaching on karma. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was traveling through the land of Kosala, and he eventually arrived at a Brahmin village called Stara. Okay, the opening of the sutta is somewhat standard and finds its opening in many sutras, that the people of this village or town hear that the Buddha has arrived. Then they hear that a certain report has been circulating about him, that he is an accomplished one, that is an arahat, fully enlightened one. He's somehow some Buddha. He's perfect in knowledge and conduct, the sublime one, knower of the world's incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. He declares or he explains the nature of this world with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas, of this population with its recluses and brahmins. It should actually be with its deities and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dharma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. He reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. So then they decide to go visit the Buddha, and so they come, they greet him in different ways. Then they sit down and they ask him the question. So now we come to paragraph 4. So when they're seated, they say to the Buddha, "Master Gotama, what is the cause and condition, what is the reason why some beings here of the dissolution of the body after death reappear in," here it's translated, "states of deprivation," or we could say in the states of misery, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, or we could say in the lower world, even in hell? And what is the cause and condition, what is the reason why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear or take rebirth in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world? Okay, now in this question, the Brahmins are asking a question which seems to be part of the shared background or shared worldview of the Indians of this period. And this is the idea that there are many planes of existence, many realms of existence. And the traditional Buddhist cosmology that we find in the early discourses stratifies these realms of existence into 5 principal realms. So of these 5 realms, we could say the center is the human realm. Then there are worlds below the human realm and worlds above the human realm. Below the human realm, there are particular realms that we share with the animals. These are visible realms. humbly boasts. And then there are the hell realms. Then above the human realm, there are various heavenly realms. So below the human realm, we have three realms which are collectively called the bad destinations or the unhappy destinations or the states of deprivation, states of misery. In these realms, the amount of suffering is much more prominent than the amount of happiness experienced. So these are realms in which suffering, pain, misery, deprivation prevail over happiness or pleasure. Then above the human realm, there is a large number of realms that are called the heavens or heavenly realms. Some of them share with us the predominance of sensory experience. So these are the sense called the sensory heavens. We don't have to go into them individually. But in these realms, the beings enjoy a prevalence of sensual pleasure, a very refined, subtle type of sensual pleasure, not like the gross sensual pleasures of human beings. So they enjoy lovely forms through the eye, probably beautiful music. They might have very delicious, subtle, refined food, very delicate fabrics, or and they spend all of their time, much of their time, just enjoying these subtle sensual pleasures. And above the sensory heavens, there are a large number of realms which are called the form heavens, or the heavens of subtle form. In these realms, the grosser types of sensual pleasure have completely vanished, and the beings here spend most of their time in kind of deep meditative bliss. They still have physical bodies, subtle physical bodies, but it's said that the lower, the coarser types of sensory experience have dropped away. The beings can still see and hear, touch, perhaps, but their minds, most of the time, when they're not, when, I don't know about the lifestyle there, but day-to-day activities, they just immediately settle back into meditative bliss, the bliss of the jhanas, of meditative absorptions. And then above the form heavens, there are some other realms which are called the formless heavens, where even physical bodily form falls away. The beings here are just like streams of mind or consciousness. And most of the time, the beings here absorb the skin. The meditator paints that equanimity of the formless absorptions. So they don't have to worry about missing buses or having to cook 2 or 3 meals a day, but since they don't have bodies, they don't have to keep up the body. But what it's like when they come out of the meditative absorption, I don't know, but most of the time they're just absorbed in this very tranquil peace, equanimity of the formless meditations. Okay, so these are the realms of existence. Some of them at least seem to have come from the general cosmology of the period, but the way they're fit together into the scheme of the 5 destinations seems to be particularly Buddhist. And it's sometimes thought, believed, especially by some modern Western commentators on Buddhism, that the Buddha just accepted this cosmological scheme because he was speaking in India during this period, and so he had to sort of take on board the Indian cultural package in order to make his message clear to the people of India. But in fact, we see over and over again in the suttas that the Buddha teaches his cosmology on his own as realms that he has himself realized through his own abhinya, or direct knowledge. And again, he explains the different types of karma that lead to rebirth into these different realms. So these are the 5 principal realms of rebirth. In the somewhat later period, a 6th realm comes to be added, which is called the realm of the asuras. The asuras are the titanic type of beings. They're almost like the Vedas, except they're depicted as being fierce and angry rather than blissful and peaceful. And often they're shown as being in a kind of state of war with the Vedas. They're trying to conquer the Deva realm, especially the realm of the 33 Vedas. And so we could, in this cosmology, we might see the Titans as being a kind of subset of the sense sphere heavenly realm. But in the early texts, the asuras are not separated off into a realm of their own. Okay, so now the Buddha, the Brahmins who have come to the Buddha are asking, what is the reason why some beings are reborn into the lower realms, and what is the reason why other beings are reborn into the higher realms? And according to the Buddhist explanation of the mechanism or dynamism that underlies the process of rebirth, according to the Buddhist teaching, that mechanism or dynamism is what is called karma, or in Pali, kamma. So it's kamma is the governing factor. Exactly. action. That's right. The word originally means action or deed. And what kind of action was common? Particular type of action. The decisive factor according to the Buddha's teaching. Right, it's volitional action. That is an action that expresses volition, that expresses intention. So an action that takes place, but it's kind of accidental action, does not create a karma. For example, if you're walking down the road in the summertime and there are insects on the road, and you step on the bug dies. It's not the karma of taking life, because you're not doing this intentionally. Of course, one should try to be mindful when walking, not to step on invisible insects. But, I mean, sometimes one can't help because one can't see them. So that doesn't create karma. And so in this sutta, the Buddha is going to use, he hasn't used the explicit word karma, but he explains it in terms of another word, which is khanda. The word that's used here is charya.
Action or conduct into two types.
And he distinguishes the action into two types according to Dhamma, which here is not being used in the narrow sense or the specific sense of the Buddha's own teachings. But the concept of Dhamma was something which was shared among just about all of the Indian spiritual teachings of this period. And so the idea of Dhamma is the idea of a kind of universal principle of goodness, righteousness, and truth that lies behind the working of the cosmic process, and that also lies behind human activity. It's the kind of, you could say, it's the ideal standard of human activity. So a king who's ruling a country, even if he doesn't know anything about Buddhism, but if he rules according righteously, if he rules benevolently, if he looks after his subjects, if he exercises justice, prudence in administering his realm, we say that he's a Dhamma Raja, that he's a righteous king.
Is it your understanding that this might be an earlier teaching of the Buddha's
plus D is what's being laid out here, basically the same as the dependent forces of unwholesome and wholesome karma. Any other questions?
A person's fears of being saved to suffer accidentally, that doesn't create karma at all, or that doesn't create a karma of killing at all?
Yeah, the act of killing the insect, stepping on it unintentionally, doesn't create the karma of killing.
It created a karma?
I don't think it would create the karma of killing.
So it's an action without any consequence?
Yeah, technically one would say it's not a karma at all. It's an action, but it's not an action that creates a karma consequence. Of course, the person will be thinking certain thoughts, and if the person is thinking unwholesome thoughts, will be creating unwholesome karma. If he's thinking wholesome thoughts, will be creating wholesome karma. But his action of stepping on the insect is not an action of killing.
It doesn't create a karma of pain, but it creates certain kind of karma. Only our heart doesn't, in certain aspect, doesn't create karma. Otherwise, every actually creates certain kind of karma. It's not a case.
In my own understanding, they only mean the act, what I would call the ethically significant parts of actions that create the karma. According to the Abhidhamma system, they say every thought, every momentary thought creates some karma, wholesome or unwholesome. I'm not sure whether that is the case, at least in the suttas, the discourses, intention is not directed to every single thought that arises in the mind, but only what I would call morally significant actions and thoughts.
Why did somebody kill another person not on purpose, like by accident? Does it create karma?
Okay, if somebody kills another person by accident,
yeah.
Even that would not create the karma of killing.
Because I think a long time ago I was speaking another course online.
Of course, on Skype.
And we also talked about the karma. Maybe it's different, like Mahayana and Theravada. Maybe it's the difference. Because the Vinaya book gave us an example. It's king. The king was playing chess with another person, and at that time, a monk came to see him. The soldier went to see the king and he wants to see the monk. But the king at that time, because he was playing the chess, and he said, "Kill. It's on chess." I don't know how to explain, but you know, it's because of chess. And he said kill, but the soldier said kill the monk. So the soldier took the monk and killed him. It's because the monk in his last life he killed the king by accident. So
the monk got killed by accident in this life.
I don't know where it comes from, because mostly I don't remember where something comes from.
I have to say that it seems probable. Because whether I kill somebody by accident or I kill somebody unintentionally, if I get the karma of killing, and then in the next life I get killed by somebody else, that only the person who kills intentionally should accumulate the karma of killing to be killed in the next life. And the king who says, kill, the way I would see it, he doesn't get the karma of killing the monk. Because it's not his intention to kill anybody, he's just playing the game. But his soldier who killed the monk, of course, he'll get the killing, the karma of killing. Because he, even though he misinterpreted the king's command, but he performed the act of killing. In fact, there's a story about the king of Ashoka, you know, the great king of India. How does it go? I think he gave a command to a minister. You know, it said that there were numerous so-called heretics infiltrating the Buddha Sangha in order to get to take advantage of the king's generosity. So the king gave an order to the minister to get rid of the phony monks, the imposters, posing as monks. And so the minister went and rounded up the people who he determined to be the phony monks and had them killed. He thought that was what the king meant by get rid of them, whereas the king only meant to expel them from the Sangha. And then when King Asoka heard this, he was worried, did I get the karma of killing? And it was always disturbing his conscience, till he met the monk and told him that you had no intention of killing any monks. So the karma is with your minister, not with yourself. Okay, one. Okay, these questions from the internet, not so really directly related to what I'm talking about.
Does every sentient being by definition have five attributes?
Does every, no, every sentient being. All sentient beings except the beings in the formless realm. In the formless realm, there's no form of everyone. Okay, so let us go on now. So when the Buddha gives this very general account of the working of karma and rebirth, the Brahmins say, we don't understand the detailed meaning of what Master Gotama has said. Please explain the Dhamma in detail so that we can understand it. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to give a detailed explanation, and this is going to be the explanation first of the 10 unwholesome types of karma, and then the 10 wholesome types of karma. Okay, so now the Buddha says that there are three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct, four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, and three kinds of mental conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma. And so you see, we have here what the Buddhist texts, they refer to as the three doors of action. That is the door of body, door of speech, and door of the mind or thought. Actually, the mind is involved in all types of karma, because the mind is in the mind that volition arises. But sometimes volition arising in the mind expresses itself through the body as a bodily action. Then it becomes bodily conduct. Sometimes volition expresses itself through speech. Then it becomes verbal conduct or verbal karma. So speech, or even nowadays we can say writing, is a form of verbal karma. Internet type of verbal karma. Nowadays, you know, people when we see them. What is this?
Text messaging.
Any other types? Someday they're going to get ways to, you just put the plug into the mic, into the ear, or maybe they'll do a little surgery to put it into the brain. And you think, I want to communicate with so-and-so, and you just think the thoughts, and the thoughts will go to so-and-so. Nowadays, we would regard that as sexual misconduct. conduct. And it seems that in the age of the Buddha's time, that was regarded as permissible. And the texts don't state whether sexual misconduct for the woman, but the commentaries say if a married woman has sexual relations with any man apart from her husband, that is sexual misconduct. And so the way it's interpreted by the commentaries, at least, it's not exactly parallel or symmetrical. And there's, I would say also that there's nothing in the early Buddhist texts which condemns homosexual relations as being sexual misconduct. Some years ago, the Dalai Lama was giving a lecture in which he said he was enumerating types of sexual misconduct, and then he mentioned homosexual relations, and it created a big furor amongst the gay and lesbian community in the U.S. But in fact, the Dalai Lama was not basing himself on any of the early Buddhist texts, but upon a medieval commentary from the 4th century called the Abhidhamma Bhusha. But there's no statement in the early Buddhist texts condemning homosexual relations as such. It's just that if an ordained monk or nun has a homosexual relationship which involves a full penetration of some sort, that it's defeated for them, just as it is if they have a heterosexual relationship. In both cases, they have to be expelled from the monastic order. Okay, so these are three types of bodily misconduct. I'll just go quickly through the other types. Verbal misconduct. Someone speaks falsehood, and then a special type is mentioned as being this would be the heaviest and gravest type of false speech. That when someone is called to a meeting or to the court, and he's questioned as a witness, tell what you know, not knowing, he says, I know, or knowing, he says, I do not know, not seeing, he says, I have seen, or having seen, he says, I did not see. So that is, in other words, bearing false witness or perjury is the most gravest form of false speech. But then to include the other types, he says, in full awareness, he speaks falsehood for his own ends, for his own benefit, or for another's end, to secure some type of worldly benefit for another person, or even for some trifling worldly benefit. So that is false speech. Then somebody speaks maliciously. This is a vice of speech. That is, he speaks to others, he tells a group of people what he's heard about somebody else in order to intentionally create divisions between them. Then he speaks harshly. He speaks words that are rough, hard, hurtful to others, offensive, bordering on anger, unconducive to concentration. And then he is a gossip, somebody who speaks at the wrong time, speaks what is not fact, speaks what is useless, speaks contrary to the dominant discipline, and so on. He speaks words that are worthless, unreasonable, dishonest, and unbeneficial. I think that includes most of us. And it seems that this is taken, I have to say, from a monastic perspective, the kind of speech that a monk should avoid. But I think if in ordinary day-to-day life we speak words that are not about the Dhamma or about the discipline, but just ordinary polite conversation, I don't think that would be included under immoderate speech. Okay, those are four types of verbal misconduct. Then three types of mental misconduct. Okay, somebody is covetous. Now sometimes the word covetousness having desire or craving, craving for some kind of sensual enjoyment. But that is not the type that creates the strong unwholesome karma that can lead to rebirth in the lower realms. But the type of unwholesome thought governed by craving that creates the unwholesome karma is coveting the wealth and property of others. That is thinking, I want to get possession of somebody else's wealth or their belongings. And so it takes the form of a wish. I wish that what belongs to others could be mine. So if I say that Heidi has a nice computer, and I think, that's a nice computer, I wish that I had a computer like that. Okay, that's a greedy thought, but it's not creating this type of unwholesome karma. But if I think, I want to get Heidi's computer, so maybe when she's not looking, I will just... What's the expression? Suffer it? Back off with it? Well, that would be stealing, but if I'm just thinking about that, planning it, or brooding, how can I get that computer? Then it becomes the unwholesome thought and consciousness, the unwholesome type of karma. Okay, the next, somebody has a mind of ill will and intentions of hate. Okay, we might have ill will towards another person, or we sometimes we don't like a particular person, or some things that other person does make us feel even hatred towards that person. Of course, that's creating unwholesome karma, but it's not the powerful unwholesome karma that can generate an undesirable rebirth. What is the unwholesome, unrighteous course of conduct that has the power to create the unwholesome rebirth is the type of hatred that takes the form of a thought, a wish, that somebody else will meet with suffering and misery, even with pain and with death. So it takes the form of the thought, may these beings be slain and slaughtered, may they be cut off, perish, or be annihilated. So if I don't like Jimmy, say, and whenever Jimmy walks into the room, my mind gets upset and angry, and I wish he'd go away. Of course, it's unwholesome thought that's creating some kind of unwholesome karma, but that isn't strong unwholesome karma with the power to create the unwholesome rebirth. But if I think, I wish Jimmy would drop dead, or I wish Jimmy would meet with some kind of misfortune, or I wish he'd get knocked off, then that is the unwholesome type of unrighteous conduct of mind. Okay, then the tenth type of unwholesome karma or unwholesome course of the tenth unwholesome course of conduct is wrong view. And this is specifically the wrong view that denies the working of the law of karma. So it takes the form that there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Nothing given in charity. That there is no fruit of result of good and bad actions. That there is not this world or any other world. No mother or father. This doesn't mean that you don't believe that beings are one from a mother or father, but it means no point in looking after one's mother or father. No point in being kind and good and generous and helpful to one's parents. no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves attained some kind of higher realization and teach the nature of this world and the other worlds. So that is the wrong view that creates the unwholesome karma, the strong unwholesome karma. And I think one has to see the classification of this type of view as an unwholesome, unrighteous course of conduct against the Buddha's time, the background of the Buddha's time, where there was a general belief, a presupposition, that a good person, a virtuous person, is one who accepts the working of the law of karma and accepts the idea of rebirth into other realms. And so if a person explicitly denies this, particularly if they say that there's no point in doing any good deeds, any charity, no point in looking up even after one's parents, no point in observing precepts. When you die, all that's left is the body. When the body gets buried, it just turns to dust. Everything finished, and those good or bad deeds all gone away. Okay, that would be the unwholesome course of action. But nowadays, we have people, you know, who were brought up on scientific background. They might say, I don't see any scientific proof for the continuation of mind or consciousness beyond death. And so I don't believe that there's any personal survival of death, but there can be very good and very ethical people who still believe that one should be generous and helpful to others, that one should observe principles of nonviolence, that one should be conscientious, member of one's community. So if they deny karma and rebirth, but still uphold the basic code of ethics as a result of moral reflection or reasoning, I don't think that their view would be a type of unwholesome karma. Okay, at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions on this.
Down to the Buddha's text. And so that's really all we know about this teaching.
reality are just the material elements, and mind or consciousness is just a byproduct of material elements. And so when the material elements that give rise to life, when they cease, then mind or consciousness can take these lives.
The other is charita. Charita means
again, it's on that loop, charity to act. So we could call this positive action or virtuous action. So the Vamrita aspect of the first type of wholesome conduct is abandoning and abstaining from killing and harming what they need. Then the charita aspect, the good aspect, or let's say positive aspect, is being gentle and kind and being compassionate to all living beings. Then we come to the second, the varita aspect is abandoning the taking of what is not given, abstaining from taking what is not given, and not taking by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or in the forest. But actually some other suttas say that one dwells honestly, one lives honestly, pure in heart. Okay, then abandon the third principle, the varita aspect. The aspect of restraining is abandoning and abstaining from misconduct and sensual pleasures, not having relations with any all of those types of women that are mentioned. And elsewhere, the positive aspect is said to be remaining what's called satisfied with one's own wife. So we could generalize that and say, remaining satisfied with one's own partner. So these are three types of bodily conduct that are in accordance with the Dhamma. Then four types of verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma. Here, okay, the aspect of Vari, that someone abandons and abstains from false speech. Then when somebody is called as a witness, he says what he knows, what he has seen, without any kind of false speech. So speaking truthfully, you can say, is the positive aspect. Which doesn't mean that one has to speak the truth, even if it offends other people. But one should always try to speak the truth when it doesn't offend anybody, or when it's the right time and the circumstances for doing so. Okay? The next one, abandoning and abstaining from malicious or divisive speech. That's the aspect of refraining. Then the positive aspect is said, one reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, one who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, one who speaks words that promote concord. Next, abandoning harsh speech and abstaining from harsh speech. That's the aspect of restraint. The positive aspect, one speaks words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as though to the heart, courteous, desired by many, agreeable to many. Then the next, one abandons and abstains from gossip or idle chatter. And the positive aspect, one speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dharma and discipline, speaks words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. So these are the four kinds of good, wholesome, verbal conduct. And three types of mental conduct in accordance with the Dharma. Okay, someone is not covetousness, and he does not covet the wealth and property of others. He is without ill will and free from intentions of hate. And instead he wishes may these beings be goodness, the mother and father. There are beings where we belong. There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who understand the nature of this world and explain them to others. Okay, so these are the 10 types of good or wholesome conduct, the types of conduct that are in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. Okay, now the Buddha ends the discourse by showing the benefits or fruits of the 10 types of good conduct. He says, if one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish after death might be reborn in the company of well-to-do nobles, the kshatriyas, the aristocrats, it is possible that he will be reborn in such a way. If he wishes, may I be reborn in the company of well-to-do Brahmins, in the company of well-to-do householders, it is possible that he will be reborn in that way. So he has, we call this a store of wholesome karma, of virtuous conduct, and that virtuous conduct is a kind of karmic fuel that can propel his consciousness into the realm of rebirth where he wants to be reborn. And so if one forms a strong aspiration to be reborn as a human being in good circumstances, then if one has sufficient karmic merits, then those merits will direct one towards that realm. Okay, if one wants to be reborn in the company of the devas, and here Buddha goes through the six set-spirit deva realms, the four great kings, the heaven of the 33, the Yama gods, the Tusita heaven, the gods who delight in creating, the gods who wield power over others' creations, those are the six set-spirit heavens. One could be reborn in those realms. Okay, if one wants to be reborn in the form realm, starting with the gods of Brahma's retinue, up through the gods of the Akanita realm, one needs as the basis the 10 types of wholesome karma. But that is not sufficient. In order to be reborn in the form realm, one also needs the power of meditation, the power of samadhi. So the basis is virtuous conduct, the 10 types of virtuous conduct, but you have to use fortified fuel. It's not enough just to have the ordinary fuel, but it has to be like when you get gasoline, super, is it typical? Ordinary gasoline and super gasoline. So this is like super gasoline. 10 types of good conduct as a basis, but then they have to pump in and through the chemistry with the power of samadhi to get to the form realm. If one wants to be reborn in the realm of infinite space, the realm of infinite consciousness, the realm of nothingness, the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, through the 10 types of wholesome karma, one can be reborn there, but that has to be reinforced or strengthened by the superpower of samadhi. That is, as a human being, one has to develop a formless meditation. Okay, then, paragraph 43, the Buddha brings in the highest aim. He says, if one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish, may I realize for myself ourselves with direct knowledge here and now and enter in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that is taintless with the destruction of the asavas, the destruction of the taints or defilements. It is possible that he can realize this liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, right here and now. Why is that? Because he observes conduct according to the Dhamma, righteous conduct. So even for attaining Nibbana, Nirvana, in this very life, the basis is the 10 courses of wholesome karma. But to reach that, one needs more than just the 10 courses. One needs the super, super, super powers of the Noble Eightfold Path. One needs also samadhi and then insight or wisdom to cut off all the defilements. Or in other words, one needs the whole Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right action, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, mindfulness, concentration, and effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Okay, so then when the Buddha finished speaking, then the Brahmins, householders, express their appreciation, and they go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and silent. In other words, a happy ending. Okay, any questions now on anything?
Favorable material conditions so that one is able Yeah, I agree with that. Then I wonder if why would the Buddha put up with admiration for the rich when the rich are withholding from the poor, but the poor need to survive and they're just squandering it on luxury.
Well, also don't forget that the Buddha praises all his generosity, giving and generosity. So maybe he sees that as a way to balance out the inequalities and standards of living. And also, probably in the Buddha's time, well, I don't know, there seem to have been quite sharp differences of living standards.
Well, I mean, in India now, there's fabulous wealth.
Yes.
Absolute poverty. And people buying it.
Yeah.
Malnutrition.
Yeah.
And for most, for Hinduism, does not mandate anything against that. There are some Hindus who are quite generous, but the problem with generosity and charity is that it means that the poor have nothing of right, they have nothing that they can expect or that they can demand or that they're entitled to, whereas they simply become dependent upon the arbitrary generosity of the rich.
Yeah.
And so there's no possibility of social justice there. So why admire the rich? Why, when someone says, well, gee, I want to live a good life so I can be reborn as a wealthy person, why would the Buddha put up with that? Why would he say, well, I don't regard that as a worthy wish?
I would want.
I said, why wouldn't he say, I don't regard that as a worthy wish, as a worthy desire?
Yeah, I have to say, yeah.
Can I consider those as stepping stones that I don't think I can achieve the final goal this life, next life, that food is not a problem, that I can practice more, it's just a stepping stone.
Yeah. And the problem is that if these people that get very rich become infatuated with their wealth and not satisfied with it. So my aspiration would be just to be sometimes like middle class. But also sometimes poverty, if it's not utterly brutalizing and degrading poverty, can be a spur for people to develop their better faculties, the faculty of being diligent, energetic, persistent, patient, hardworking, and then to work themselves up into. And in this way, they will develop certain qualities that can then be directed in spiritual growth. Well, it's good for people who are sitting and take the microphone. Maybe. Patricia,
thank you so much for your teaching. It wasn't until I had almost no money that I truly had compassion for what people had.
Yeah.
Until I had my own experience of something that I really knew what it was about. So I'm very happy that I wasn't born with a lot of money, although I did inherit quite a bit of money, but didn't know what to do with it. Because I didn't have a background of knowledge about having money in this lifetime. Until I had no more money, then I had the question about what should I have done when I had money. So it goes around and around like this, but I'm very grateful that I don't have that money because of the wonderful experience I've had seeing how it is for other people that have no jobs and no food and no clothing, which is a million times worse or less than what I have. So I think it's all a teacher for us, whether we have a lot of money or not. And I think if we look at the benefit of what we learn as an abundance rather than the amount of money we have, and I know many, many people who are very, very wealthy, who are very, very good-hearted, but their experience is different, so they can only do what they know.
Yeah.
So,
I just wanted to add that from other things I've read, and I can't cite anything, that my sense of the Buddha talking about
speaks about that they should invest a certain amount in their business, use a certain amount to provide for their own material well-being, a certain amount to provide the taxes to the government, to perform certain duties to the relatives. Then another portion, a substantial portion, is used for giving to the constantly.
That would be the portion.
Yeah.
Thank you. is